kids stuck in legal limbo this side of the border. Today, Tuesday, October 14th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Salvadoran teenager seeks asylum in the U.S. after fleeing gang violence back home. This reporter is following her case.
She's very, very serious. She does have the demeanor of someone who's been traumatized.
Also today, a photographer discovers what unites prisoners and guards at Guantanamo Bay.
No one has chosen to live in this place. And life for both groups is defined by routine, by order, and by boredom.
Plus, I get quizzed by an English professor.
So would you say what you think the word soul means?
Soul, S-O-U-L?
Yeah.
Soul is one's kind of... Ooh, boy, that's a tough one.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Okay, strange question, but what do you wear to an asylum hearing? If you're pleading not to be sent out of the U.S. to a country where you may end up dead, you better look your best. We all heard a lot this summer about the wave of unaccompanied Central American kids coming to the U.S. Many were fleeing violence back home. Every one of their tales is unforgettable, but even for those who were lucky enough not to get deported, it's not over. Amy Isaacson has one young immigrant story.
Last June, a girl we're calling Maria, who's 15 years old, put on the best clothes of the few she had for an appointment at the U.S. Asylum Office in Los Angeles. She would essentially plead for her life.
Que hace como dos años, pues, yo tuve una amiga que murió muy fríamente.
Maria remembers telling the asylum officer how a close friend of hers was murdered 2 years ago. She identified the body. It was cut into pieces, stuffed into a big dog food bag. Through tears, Maria says when police pulled out a leg, she saw her friend's birthmark. She says it made her not believe in God. Maria, who asked us not to use her real name, then saw another friend get shot by gang members and later found him hanging from a tree. Just two stories of the violence she witnessed in El Salvador and why she fled.
Yo creo que moriría si regresara.
Maria told the officer that she thinks she'd be killed if she went home. The gang thinks she knows too much. Maria's story is not unusual. Just a fraction of the more than 66,000 kids caught at the border during the last year will qualify for asylum. That's because the definition of refugee is narrow. Asylum officers must find that a child suffered harm based on race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group, and that their government couldn't or wouldn't protect them. It's belonging to a particular social group under threat that's at the core of many asylum claims of children like Maria. The argument is that young people who resist gangs constitute a persecuted group. But it's an evolving area of the law. Patricia Ortiz is an attorney at a nonprofit that's handling Maria's case. She said it'd be almost impossible for Maria to navigate this process alone.
I don't know that someone who's doing this on their own would even know what to look for and what evidence they would need to present. I don't know that they would have the knowledge.
Unlike people in criminal proceedings, these kids, in immigration proceedings, do not have a right to a government-appointed attorney. California and the federal government will pay for some legal aid, but building an asylum case is still tough. It can mean collecting evidence thousands of miles away. In Maria's case, Ortiz wanted a copy of the death certificate for Maria's friend, the one whose body she identified, to strengthen the claim.
Que eso era muy, muy peligroso para él.
But Maria says her friend's father said no because it was too dangerous. He worried the gang would retaliate and kill one of his other kids if he helped. Maria's lawyer made do with a news article to prove the murder happened. Kids who have pro bono lawyers from private law firms can fare better. Damian Robinson says his big L.A. law firm spent thousands of dollars to gather evidence in Guatemala to help a girl win asylum.
There are pages and pages and pages of witness statements. They're very serious criminal things, death threats over and over, and nothing was done.
Robinson thinks this evidence made his client's horrific story believable.
the fact that there are people who are in a similar situation who don't have the opportunity to stay here is just, it's just really scary.
Some members of Congress doubt these kids' claims and say it's too easy for them to get asylum, though just 108 claims were granted in the first 9 months of the last fiscal year. Republicans have sponsored bills to send kids home faster. Meanwhile, Maria waits to see what's next.
Estamos en mi casa, pues yo vivo en Los Ángeles.
She says she's at her dad's house in L.A. and is enrolled in high school. The asylum officer told her she'd hear about her case in 2 weeks. It's already been 3 months. For The World, I'm Amy Isaacson.
Amy's story was reported in collaboration with Susan Ferris at the Center for Public Integrity. And Susan Ferris joins us now. Susan, you co-reported the story. You know this catalog of horrors Maria has witnessed. You also spent a good deal of time at home with Maria and her father in Los Angeles. So suddenly she's here, away from that violence. How's she adjusting?
She actually spent quite a bit of time in a shelter in Texas after she was detained by the Border Patrol. And she did get some degree of counseling there and began to talk about her experiences. But she's very, very serious. And to me, she does have the demeanor of someone who's been traumatized.
Yeah, I was going to say, where does that seriousness come from?
I think it comes from her background, what she's been through recently, not just crossing the border, the horror stories she described, and also basically being extorted. We have a 15-year-old girl who has a story of being extorted for $60 a month that she handed over from money that her father would send her to El Salvador to live on.
And now he knows what those remittances were actually for.
Yes, he was really worried because he felt that the price was going to keep increasing and that there was impunity and there was no way to really stop it.
How is she getting along with her dad in Los Angeles? Are they finding time to catch up, or just does she have other concerns on her mind?
I think she is worried about her future. She seems to be aware that she may have an appeal ahead of her if she isn't granted asylum right away. She seems to be getting along pretty well with her dad. Her dad's a truck driver, so he's not there all the time. But she has other family members she's getting to know.
That's pretty nice to hear. Is she able to concentrate?
I think she will probably feel much better if she knows what her status is going to be. This is a big thing to shoulder for a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
I have a daughter her age, and it's hard for me to imagine having to live with waiting to know if you're going to be allowed to remain or be sent back.
What is the incentive for going through kind of the official legal process? I mean, if they're so desperate, what's to prevent them from just coming through the border and just being off the books?
Well, I think that has happened. Some kids have disappeared. Of course, they will be ordered deported in absentia if they don't show up to immigration court. I think right now, the latest statistics I've seen are that the majority are showing up to court. Mm. Just a reminder, these children are not entitled to appointment of attorney, so they really must find either their families have to pay for someone or they must find volunteers.
Well, the fact that they're going through these legal channels, I guess that's a sign that these kids are sincere about their attempts to flee real crime.
Well, I think many of them are. And lawyers that we spoke with for the story told us they do turn down kids that come in. And they feel that when they don't feel that the kids have a claim for asylum or some other type of remedy to deportation, they won't take their cases. Hmm. So you're not getting every kid who comes through the system or who is entered trying to get asylum.
Susan Ferris, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was reporter Susan Ferris of the Center for Public Integrity. You can read an excerpt of the full story co-reported by Susan and Amy Isaacson at PRI.org. And we have a Facebook chat about the story going on right now. You can join it at Facebook.com/PRI the world. From the Celtic tiger to the declawed Celtic kitten, Ireland may now be getting some of its economic claws back. After dealing with some grueling spending cuts recently, Ireland's finance minister today rolled out next year's budget, and there are signs it's stepping on the gas again. The government's counting on strong economic growth this year. It's so confident that it's moving to phase out special tax breaks, really special, as in allowing multinationals like Apple, Google, and Facebook to save billions of dollars in taxes by sticking a lot of untaxed revenue in Ireland. Irish novelist Peter Cunningham has written about the 2008 collapse of the Irish economy and its impact. Peter, how'd you feel about this loophole coming to a likely end?
Well, Marco, I feel that Ireland as a small country should use all the weapons it can get into its armory to get jobs over here, because it's all about jobs in Ireland. And we've very successfully turned a small agricultural country over 20 years into a European Silicon Valley by using a lot of things at our disposal. Irish people are very highly educated, they speak English, but also by using taxes.
Is it really a Silicon Valley, though? I mean, did innovation come about as a result of this loophole?
Well, certainly from the point of view of Irish people, I mean, maybe that's what we refer to it as, but maybe that's too romantic a description. But it has certainly resulted in tens of thousands of jobs, very welcome jobs for the Irish economy. Now, the Irish government has come under huge pressure from the OECD, from the EU, and from Britain to change our tax regime. And today we did partly change by dropping the double Irish mechanism to reduce tax even further. But we've kept our 12.5% corporation profits tax, which is not up for grabs. And we've reduced the tax rate on intellectual property. So actually, as a result of today's budget, there's going to be little change.
Why did Ireland establish this loophole in the first place?
Well, I mean, loophole, can I, in a very friendly and respectful way...
You don't like the use of my word loophole there.
Loophole.
I can tell.
One man's loophole is another man's opportunity. And loophole is a pejorative term. So it is simply imaginative and attractive taxation architecture. Ireland is a country with few natural resources. You know, we can't rely on other people to provide jobs in this open economy. We've come through the most appalling bust, and we've emerged from that remarkably. We've done so on our own, not with the help of any large political power blocks. Of course, if each job which we attract to Ireland using a tax like this is a job lost for Germany, for example, and that's what it's all about. It's about competition in the market. We've nothing to be ashamed of in using this long-established tax architecture, and we should stick to it.
As you know, none other than Bono said today that this tax privilege brought Ireland its only prosperity ever. But what I want to ask you is, what about the cultural prosperity of, you know, like you too, not to mention the great novels of people like you and James Joyce? Don't the Irish want to be known for that, not as a Celtic Cayman Islands?
Look, we have no problem in being culturally vibrant as well. We're extraordinarily culturally vibrant, but that doesn't mean we have to be poor. People are very, really concerned about their own jobs and how much it's going to cost them to buy a house. It's the same as everywhere all over the world. And today, for example, in the budget, there was a 2.2 billion euro social housing scheme announced. So we've come from a point of being in the hands of the IMF to exiting the IMF program. We did that by gritting our teeth and by working very hard. And we should stick to our knitting, which is by attracting companies, by having a favorable tax regime. And that's what we're going to continue to do.
Is there a lesson here about the soul of Ireland somewhere?
Well, the soul of Ireland got tarnished very badly in the time of the Celtic Tiger. As we say over here, we lost the run of ourselves. It was just a classic bubble. It wasn't confined to Ireland, but it hit Ireland very severely. But meanwhile, this is still the Emerald Isle, is still the island of saints and scholars, is still the most beautiful country in the world, and we're in business.
Irish novelist Peter Cunningham, he's the author of, among many books, Capital Sins, a novel set during the Irish financial crisis. Good to talk with you, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up later on The World, how Ebola is derailing the season for Sierra Leone's national soccer team. You're listening to PRI's The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Some foreign words have a certain untranslatable je ne sais quoi. Take the French word chouette. Literally means a type of owl, but more frequently people use chouette to describe something that's cute, neat, nice or friendly, or even terrific or fantastic, all depends on the context. That's what I mean by untranslatable. Or is it? Is anything really untranslatable? For the answer to that, I turn to Michael Wood. He's an English professor at Princeton University and one of the editors of the Dictionary of Untranslatables. I gather you have a quiz for me. That's how we're going to start this interview. So go on, ask me a few questions, Michael.
Okay, Marco. Well, the first part of the quiz is to ask you to define an English word. One of the things you learn about when you think about translating, especially about untranslatable, is that we often don't know quite what we mean by our own words in our own language. So would you say what you think, let's say, the word soul means?
Soul, S-O-U-L?
Yeah.
Soul is one's kind of... Ooh, boy, that's a tough one. Soul is one kind of spirit being, if you will, one's mind, the kind of consolidation of thought and belief.
Very nice. If you had to distinguish between soul and spirit, how would you do it?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Spirit, I will say, I'm going to go for a German word here, is one's Zeitgeist. It's kind of like what motivates one. And soul is more kind of Soul is more of a an essence, kind of like the life force. Oh boy,
and those are great definitions, and I think they illustrate how much play there is in these words. You know, that once you start thinking about them, all kinds of stuff comes to mind.
So your dictionary is called the Dictionary of Untranslatables. It's actually a translation from French. So clearly, you got through translating 400 literary, philosophical, and political terms. Somehow.
Yeah.
What do you actually mean, though, by the term untranslatable?
It's a very contested term. It's got several meanings, but in one simple sense, it's important to be clear about, nothing is untranslatable. Mm. You can always translate it somehow. You know, you can patch it up, you can fix it. Translation is not, it's not an art of perfection. It's not copying. It's rendering in one language something that began in another language, and you can always do it. You can always get there in some way. But there is a sense with many words that when you've translated them, you just feel you haven't done the job, even when you've done the best job you could.
And why is that?
It's not because there's something essential, I think, in the other language that you can't translate, but there's something interesting that you're really missing. If you know the other language, you feel you haven't got it into the new language. It's that residue, that sense of something missing. It's not quite what gets lost in translation because it wasn't found in the first place. But it's some difference that you treasure. So it's really about differences. Barbara Cassin, the editor of the French volume, she defines the untranslatable as that which one can't stop translating.
Well, I think of the Portuguese word saudade, which is used a lot in Brazilian music. And you say to a Brazilian, what does that mean? They say, oh, it's untranslatable. But then they will go on to describe it as a sense of longing for the past, slightly mournful, but also slightly warm sense of the past, almost a nationalistic sadness. And then I say to the Brazilians, see, you just translated it. So
exactly, yeah.
give me a word in English that you find is the example you kind of roll out as an untranslatable English word.
Well, there are lots of them, but I think the word fair, for example, fair and fairness is pretty much untranslatable. There's no equivalent in German, French, or Spanish, or any language that I know. There's a very good entry in the dictionary on the word fair by a French philosopher. She knows the meaning of the word, but at a certain point, she sort of seems to think of being fair is just getting things right and doing things by the book. Whereas my idea is that sometimes, to be fair, you'd have to not do things by the book.
Interesting. So it's not just simple justice or a sense of being just.
It's not equality justice. Like it seems to me there's something more, a little more mysterious and more intuitive and more to do with local occasions.
This book, since it had been written in French, it was then translated into a number of other languages, Russian and Arabic and Farsi. Mm-hmm. Why apparently did English pose such a challenge in translating this book of untranslatables?
Partly because it's a global language. A lot of people speak English. It's the one foreign language they speak. So it has a lot of sort of traction and a lot of interest and so on. And also partly because the French book was sort of written in a way against English, right? That is, it was meant to defend the multiplicity of European languages as against the invasion of global English taking over the whole world. So there was a kind of interesting paradox in putting the thing into English. When in fact, English was what it didn't want to be. so that was kind of difficult.
One place the notion of untranslatables seems to take us is kind of almost stereotyping different cultures and people who speak those languages. So, you know, the possible danger of seeing that there is a French way of being happy or a German way, doesn't that lead to stereotypes and generalizations?
the attraction of difference, of seeing that everything is different and cultures are different and people are different, that's all good things. Everything local and specific is all good. But the danger, I think, is the one you identify, that at some point the specificity will be some kind of essence, some natural essence, stereotypes, and every French person will be, you know, impeccably French, every English person will be impeccably English, and so on. I think that's not good. And so that has to be resisted, but it's very tricky.
Yeah. What is your favorite untranslatable term from the dictionary?
The Spanish word desengaño, disenchantment is what it means. There's similar uses for the French word illusion, for example. In English, English speakers are such pragmatic folks that you think if you're to be disillusioned is to be deprived of your illusions, and a good thing too, because now you know the truth. In every Romance language, the notion of being undeceived also means disappointment, as if you didn't really want to be undeceived.
Hmm.
You would think that a title like Balzac's Lost Illusions would mean, okay, good, now we woke up, we wised up, we know what the truth is. But actually, that title is full of regret. It's as if we wanted to keep our illusions.
You know, Michael, I'm just curious, how do you envision a reader practically using this dictionary of untranslatables? The risk is that they start reading this book and they go down a rabbit hole.
I think the way to read the book is just absolutely just by little bits. You know, you find a word you're interested in and you track out the word. It's like a maze, like a labyrinth. You would follow the signs and one day maybe you'd come out, but maybe you wouldn't. You would just be lost in there forever.
Mm. You know? Well, mission accomplished. I certainly got lost in it this weekend.
Okay.
English professor at Princeton, Michael Wood. He's also one of the editors of the recently translated Dictionary of Untranslatables. Michael, thank you a lot.
Thanks very much, Michael. It was a real pleasure.
That conversation is part of our series, In Other Words, Looking at How Translation Has Changed the English-Speaking World. Explore more stories at pri.org/inotherwords. Okay, this next bit does not need translating, for us English speakers at least. Today's the day the Man Booker Prize is awarded. That's Britain's best-known literary prize. And what interests us isn't so much who the winner is, but the fact that Americans were eligible this year for the first time. That broadened the range of accents among the shortlisted authors. Here they are talking about their literary influences.
Hello, my name is Joshua Ferris, and I'm the author of To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. The first thing that comes to mind is Ralph Waldo Emerson, not exactly a book writer, but he was an essayist and diarist from the 19th century.
Hello, I'm Howard Jacobson, author of Jay. The books that have been most important to me are novels by Dickens and novels by D.H. Lawrence.
I'm Ali Smith, and my book is called How to Be Both. But if I think of the books that I'd like to say had influenced me, it's like a list that kind of stretches out to the crack of doom, which begins with Lewis Grassic Gibbon.
I'm Neil Mukherjee, and I am the author of The Lives of Others. A German writer called Heinrich Böll, V.S. Naipaul, is a great influence on my life, and the Australian novelist Patrick White.
I am Karen Joy Fowler, writer of We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. The book I usually cite is T.H. White's The Once and Future King.
It's Richard Flanagan, author of The Narrow Road to the Deep North. William Faulkner, when he was asked what were his three favourite books, replied, Anna Karenina, Anna Karenina, Anna Karenina. I only have to say it once, Anna Karenina.
And I'll say this just once, you're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, the story behind a counterintuitive photograph.
It's a pastoral scene, a rocky beach looking out over the ocean. Five lounge chairs are laid out. There's a person on one of those chairs, and he's in full military fatigues.
Documenting life at Guantanamo, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Unprecedented and stunning are not words you hear much to describe news from the Vatican. Then again, Catholic bishops don't often put out a statement that recognizes the gifts and qualities that gay people can offer the church. The Catholic Church has traditionally condemned homosexuality, but apparently the bishops gathered in Rome this week are a bit more open-minded than they've been in the past. BuzzFeed's Lester Fader has written extensively on the Vatican. Lester, when you hear that line, homosexuals have gifts and qualities to offer to the Christian community, how do you react?
Well, I think it's amazing to see the Catholic leadership really struggle with a tension inside the church. On the one hand, there's no sign that the church is changing its fundamental feeling about homosexuality and about same-sex relationships. In that same statement, they reiterated that same-sex unions could not be regarded as the same as heterosexual marriage. But it is certainly clear there are elements inside the church that are looking to end the really strict division on this and try to find a way to incorporate LGBT people inside the church. And of course, the most important element in that discussion is the Pope himself, who has made several statements showing an openness to being inclusive, while always being fairly clear that that doctrine was not necessarily on the table up for change.
Pope Francis has brought a lot of change to the Vatican since he arrived on the scene last year. Does he have a lot of support within the church hierarchy for this?
Well, clearly enough to be able to get a large number of leaders to have this discussion, but he's got very, very strong opposition as well. You know, in a kind of extraordinary move right before the synod began, a group of conservative cardinals released a book not bending on LGBT rights, but also for holding a very strong line on changing the church's teachings about divorce. But I would say that, you know, the Pope brings really interesting experience to this. He's the first pontiff to come from a country that has recognition for same-sex marriages. And he was the head in Argentina, yes. And we've seen since almost as soon as he became pope, a desire to shift the conversation away from these so-called culture war issues and to open a space for some kind of reconciliation with gay Catholics, even though the church really is in a position where it can't and doesn't want to change its actual teaching on homosexuality.
Right. If the Vatican pushes ahead on loosening policy, would it imply a change to teachings of the church?
I don't know if it would apply a change to teachings, but it would certainly it would be a very substantial change in the way that it handles these issues. And it's actually worth pointing out that this discussion document is actually more dramatic in some ways in what it seems to be saying about where the church is headed on divorce for a long time. As long as the church has been teaching on this, there was an opposition to divorce to the point where people who had been divorced and remarried could not receive communion. And there is discussion language in this document, which is still under development, that seems to be suggesting there's looking for a path by which people who have divorced and remarried could at some point receive communion again. And that, from a doctrinal perspective, is a pretty extraordinary step if it were to happen.
If the Vatican chooses to push ahead with this, what about selling the idea to the flock?
Well, I think you get real receptiveness in Europe, you know, and perhaps the place where you might get the most immediate change would be Italy. It's the only country in Western Europe that does not have any legal recognition for same-sex couples. They're in the middle of a very harsh debate over a proposal to bring civil unions into effect. And even if the church isn't changing its policy, it's expressing a more open-minded, a less hostile position. What will be interesting is in countries like Nigeria or Uganda, other places where there are these very politicized efforts to impose very extreme anti-gay laws.
So, Lester, how big a change is this, do you think?
It's a huge change to see a pope who is very actively trying to take down the tone of the debate is a major move. What that means in the long run and whether that gets to anything that looks like true acceptance of same-sex relationships, I think we're still a long way for that. But, you know, this is an institution that has existed for 1,000 years, and that's takes time. Change takes time. You know, we are seeing a moment where we may be seeing the beginnings of a change in direction.
Lester Fader at BuzzFeed, thanks as always.
Thank you.
6 months. That's how long those kidnapped girls have been missing in Nigeria. You remember the story? More than 270 girls were abducted by the militant group Boko Haram last April from a school in the town of Chibok in rural northern Nigeria. It's been 6 months of public appeals, social media hashtags, and rescue promises by the Nigerian government. Today, the missing girls' parents are still waiting for news. As we hear in this report from our BBC colleague in Nigeria, Will Ross.
At this roundabout in a very busy part of Lagos, there's a reminder, a very poignant reminder, of the tragedy that struck 6 months ago. Because on display all the way around the roundabout are placards with the names of all 219 girls who are still in captivity. They're just silhouetted faces with red question marks over their faces, and then their names written underneath with the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. Blessing Abana, Rejoice Sankey, Ruth Amos, Awa Beatrice, Laraba Paul, Kauna Lalai, Deborah Abana.
This is an act of pure evil. It's united people across the planet to stand with Nigeria to help find these children and return them to their parents.
David Cameron and many other world leaders denounced the abductions and offered help. The Nigerian government at first refused to admit what had happened. Then over the last 6 months, we've heard promises of imminent rescue, but no facts. Just plenty of rumours, such as the girls have been split into smaller groups and maybe taken across Nigeria's borders. Today, in the remote farming community of Chibok, the agony continues for the anxious relatives, like Muhammad Yahaya, whose teenage daughter Yana is missing.
We want the international community to put pressure on the government. The government must do more to get our daughters back. Some parents are already dying. About 6 women have gone insane because they are vulnerable and can't endure the trauma like men. Even us, the men, are broken.
In July, Muhammad and other parents travelled to the capital, Abuja, to meet the president. They received cash and a promise.
President Goodluck Jonathan promised us that we will soon be reunited with our children by the end of August. August has passed, September as well, and we have not heard anything about them.
It's the total lack of any official information that hurts most for Hanatu Dauda, who last heard from her daughter Saratu during a brief mobile phone conversation as she was being driven away from her school in a lorry.
We are in a desperate situation. Sometimes when we go to the farm and remember what has happened, we just start crying. There is no information about our daughters. We just hear that they would soon be rescued. The most painful thing is that we don't even know where they're being held. Since they were kidnapped, we always pray to God that one day we will be reunited.
Since the girls were seized in April, the situation in the northeast of Nigeria has deteriorated dramatically, and Boko Haram jihadists have forced entire communities to flee their homes to camps like these. Boko Haram has killed thousands and now controls towns and villages. The abductions haven't stopped. Fourteen-year-old Abubakar tells me when his family fled Gwoza, his brother, who's 18, hid in the mountains. But when sneaking to the river to fetch water, he was captured by the jihadists. Abubakar has not seen his brother or his parents since. As the war rages on, campaigners have kept on marching on the streets calling for the abducted girls to be rescued. Yemi Adamolekan says it's the only way to put any pressure on the government to respond.
The Chief of Defence Staff came out May 24th and said we know where the girls are. May 24th, June, July, August, September, now we're in October. Nothing else. So you know where they were in May, where are they now? And what have you done about that? So if people don't keep talking about it, it goes out of people's consciousness. There's a lot more going on in the world. There's a lot more going on in Nigeria. However, we're able to keep it in the front burner that these girls are still missing. They are still missing. That hasn't changed.
Back in Chibok, Muhammad says Nigeria's politicians are far more focused on next year's elections than on his missing daughter.
I think the government is more concerned about politics now. We don't hear about our girls anymore. We only hear about political campaigns going on. That is what they are concerned about.
And many Nigerians feel that's true of all politicians from whichever party, as the agonising wait goes on for the long list of missing girls.
Hawa Muta, Mary Amor, Awagana Musa, Esther Joshua, Ruth Joshua, Esther Mar-
That was the BBC's Will Ross reporting from Nigeria. When I think of Cuba and I push politics aside, I think of bright colors and lush greenery, unless I'm thinking about the U.S. military detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Then it's fluorescent lights and drab, dreary colors that come to mind. Photographer Debbie Cornwall captured this visual contradiction about life in Guantanamo recently. Her work was part of the Leiden International Photography Festival. Debbie joins me now from New York. What prompted you to take on this project? Why Guantanamo specifically?
Well, this is my first project returning to documentary photography after a career as a civil rights lawyer representing the wrongly convicted in the United States. So stepping away from litigation, I was interested in looking at some of the same issues that concerned me as a lawyer, but from a new perspective.
Well, take us down to Guantanamo, if you would. I mean, let's start with the people. You actually refused to take pictures of the detainees. Tell us why.
Well, it's an uncomfortable thing to be given a view through a one-way glass of men who are held in captivity, and more than half of the 149 men still held there for almost 13 years now were cleared for release years ago. They're innocent, but they're still being held. I didn't go to look at them through that window.
And those were the regulations, those were the outlines from the officials. You have to look and photograph them through this one-way mirror, or?
That was the only opportunity to see the detainees there. All of the photographs are very strictly regulated there. Photographers may not make any images of anyone's face, whether a detainee or a guard or a civilian. So it's that much more difficult to convey the human experience when you can't photograph someone's face.
So how hard was it to get access? I mean, you've got some pictures that are really telling of, you know, stuff like a kid's floaty toy in a little swimming pool. But, I mean, did you need access for that?
I did. Like any member of the media who is granted access to Guantanamo Bay, I was accompanied at all times by a member of the military's public affairs office, given the access that they were willing to provide. And there was a negotiation. But one of the first things I was told when I arrived for my first trip was, Gitmo is the best posting a soldier can have. There's lots of fun to be had here. So knowing that I would not have an opportunity to meet with or photograph the detainees, I thought, fine, show me the fun, and I will photograph evidence of that experience in both residential and leisure spaces for both detainees and guards on the base.
Yeah, these photographs don't actually connote fun. Describe one of the pictures for us.
Well, one of my favorites is an image of a rocky beach looking out over the ocean. Five lounge chairs are laid out. And the more you look at the picture, the more you will realize there's a person on one of those chairs, and he's in full military fatigues. It's not the kind of image we think of when we think of going to the beach, having a day off, or the kind of image we think about when we think about the prisons of Guantanamo Bay. It was that kind of shock, that kind of juxtaposition that I was looking for in my pictures.
That idea that Guantanamo is the best posting you'll ever get, did you talk to the soldiers there? Did they agree with that? Do they think it's cushy?
I think yes and no. On my second trip back, I had more of an opportunity to spend time with the soldiers who were showing me around, and they had had many more months on base in their tours since I had first met them. And one of the things that became apparent was that while the two populations, prisoners and guards, are not at all equivalent, there is one human experience that both groups have in common, and that is that no one has chosen to live in this place. And life for both groups is defined by routine, by order, and by boredom.
If someone's listening to this interview and they say, well, you know, Guantanamo is a prison. Prisons are not supposed to be cushy places. How do you respond to that?
What I saw on this visit spoke to a human experience of discomfort. And I think Guantanamo Bay speaks to our fears in responding to September 11th. And it speaks to perhaps ways that we could do better in responding to the terrorist attacks that prompted those fears.
Photographer Debbie Cornwall, you can see her pictures from Guantanamo at PRI.org. Debbie, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
You are listening to The World. Marco Werman here, and you're tuned to The World. Facebook's CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his wife today joined the list of donors offering to help with anti-Ebola efforts. They're donating $25 million to help deal with the epidemic in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Those are the three most affected nations in West Africa. And while Liberia's struggle has gotten the most coverage, the other countries are also facing deep challenges with the disease. In Sierra Leone, for example, officials recently admitted the country's health facilities are overwhelmed with Ebola patients. So they're now allowing families there to tend to their sick loved ones at home. That gives you an idea of how serious the challenge is for Sierra Leone. The epidemic also has meant that people from that country are treated like outcasts when they travel. That's happened to Michael Lahoud. He's a soccer player for Sierra Leone. He plays professionally here in the U.S. for the Philadelphia Union. He also travels back to Africa regularly to join Sierra Leone's national soccer team. Recently, the squad was flying to the Seychelles to play the national team there when the Sierra Leonean athletes were stopped in transit.
On our way to get on our flight from Nairobi, Kenya, we got kicked off our flight and quarantined. The Seychelles government had issued an international ban on every single member of our team that was listed on the roster. So within the Seychelles country, our photos were all over the place. Our information was all over the news. And, they warned the Kenyan government that if we would have landed on that flight on Kenyan Airways in the Seychelles, then they would have put us right back on the flight and kicked us out of their country.
And another telling detail to add insult to injury, the Seychelles team forfeited the match instead of playing.
Yeah, that was definitely insult to injury. Our team and our government was even willing to find a neutral venue for them to leave the Seychelles and come. We were going to play them anywhere in Africa, wherever they wanted. They said they were going to forfeit because they didn't want to take a chance on any of us having Ebola, and they were pretty convinced that one of us may have had Ebola, and their economy is tourism. They said that having us in the country puts their economy, let alone their people, in danger. That's pretty crushing.
Yeah, other upsetting details, when you do play matches, you hear chants of Ebola from the opposing fans. You also have to deal with the fact that a lot of teams are not shaking your hands or trading jerseys with you. I mean, it's not surprising that I guess you've kind of exiled yourself away from Sierra Leone, even though that's also got to be disappointing because no national teams will come there right now to play you. Where is the team's home base right now?
Well, we have to play all our games away. So we have forfeited the right to have home games for an indefinite date. For whatever reason, Guinea, which is where the virus broke out, Morocco accepted them, to put their home base there. And for whatever reason, we have taken the role of the ultimate outcast, where no country in the continent of Africa will take us in. It makes it really tough and really frustrating to have to deal with that on top of the difficulty of already playing as an away team in Africa.
So you're a team without a country right now.
Yeah, none of us have been able to go back. They shut down the borders to our country. All of us have family there. All of us have many close ties, homes, for some guys, wives, kids. This is a very personal issue.
How's it affecting morale on the team?
I think this is bringing our team closer together. Some of the things that we've had to go through, hearing the chant of Ebola, having to be quarantined every country we go into, having to be asked to pay, in a couple countries we went into, normally a visa is like $50. Well, other countries are demanding that we pay, up to $700 to even be allowed to, start the visa process, not even get a visa, but just $700 to even be considered for a visa. It's ridiculous, but
it sounds like they're trying to make it prohibitive.
Yeah, no, they're every obstacle that you can imagine that's being, that can be put in the way without just being blatantly discriminatory is being done.
Despite these unfortunate obstacles, Michael, you're doing your part for sure to help stop this crisis or help solve this crisis. Tell us about the fundraising effort you're doing to support Doctors Without Borders in Sierra Leone.
Yeah, because of these experiences I've had with our national team in particular, a friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Thilo Kunkel at Temple University, we decided to start the Kick Ebola on the Butt campaign. That came about from a coffee cup conversation that I was telling Thilo about my experiences in the Seychelles and Kenya. And, he blurred the punchline out in the middle of the conversation. I think we just need to kick Ebola on the butt. I think we just got to do that. Kick it right in the butt. And so, you know, very organic beginning to all this. And Ebola has been looked at as an African problem. And disease is never just a, oh, that's just over there. Disease can very, very quickly become an international problem. This campaign asked a pretty simple question. Are you willing to put your butt on the line for the good of someone else? And so the premise behind it is you pick a partner, your husband, your wife, someone you don't like, a frenemy, an enemy, whoever, and they get a chance to take a shot at your butt. If they hit your butt from 5 yards away.
And we're talking with a soccer ball now.
Yeah, with a nice soft soccer ball, not a baseball.
Too much air in it.
Yeah. Then you donate to Doctors Without Borders. On the flip side, if they miss your butt, then they will donate to Doctors Without Borders. And so we're just trying to take something fun, you know, a sport that's growing in this country and the most popular sport in the world, and trying to use it for a good cause.
And to kick things off, you put your own butt on the line there, Michael.
Yeah, Tilo, man, it's crazy. Like, you take all these practice shots and you think someone's going to miss by miles, and Tilo hit me pretty hard. I think I still got the Adidas brand on there. So, but yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it's something that's very important to me. And pretty much all my teammates here in Philadelphia have taken the challenge, and we're just hoping to just keep it growing and bring even more awareness to Ebola and kind of begin the fight back towards this, you know, pretty awful virus and disease.
Well, good on you, Michael. Michael Lahoud plays for the Philadelphia Union and for Sierra Leone's national team. Thanks very much.
No, thanks for having me, guys. Take care.
If you want to see Michael Lahoud getting a kick in the butt, we've got the video at PRI.org. He's a good sport. He's an exceptional sport. But I hear stories like Michael's, and I need to hear an uplifting song like this. This is from the debut album by Malian singer Awasango. The song is called Alata, and in it, Awasango sings in the West African Bambara language about the importance of living with a belief in something. Kindness, loyalty, hard work, fill in the blank with your own value. That'll do it for us today on The World. We tweet and Instagram at PRI The World. You can find me there as well at Marco Werman, or right here on the radio tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. See you then.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi. By the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.